Les colloques du Collège de France.
Yeah, our next speaker is Wendy Bigmore, and Wendy is the head of the Institute of Cancer Research, Genetic and Cancer University of Edinburgh, in fact, in the MRC, Human Genetic Institute. Wendy.
Thank you, Denis. Thank you for the invitation to this fascinating colloquium. Wonderful to talk about enhancers with you for a whole day. We are remarkable animals, not because of the number of genes we have in our genome, which is not much more than a fruit fly, but because of the way we can use those genes. We can control their expression exquisitely in time and place, as Guillaume has very nicely introduced to you. So that means we can have one gene, SOX2, SOX9, Sonic Hedgehog, and then use it to help pattern the eye during development, and then we can take the same gene again and use it to control the activity of a neuron during a particular process of brain function. Or we can use that same gene again to help the heart respond to a physiological stimulus. So enhancers are absolutely fascinating. There are hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of them in our genome, and I find it frankly shocking that we don't know where all the enhancers are in the human genome, where they are, what they do, what genes they act on, and how they do it. So it's a massive gap in our understanding of the genome. So I just wanted to start by kind of going back to what Denis said at the beginning and thinking about what is an enhancer and what does it do? It clearly is the place where you integrate the information about cell type, developmental time, and position within the embryo through the binding of tissue-specific transcription factors, whose job it is then to recruit the transcriptional coactivators, the P300 complex, the mediator complex. But it is also, and I think one of the papers that he talked about said it's also a place for polymerase to get in. Yes, it is, because enhancers also recruit RNA polymerase, and they actually transcribe. They're not that different from gene promoters. It's just that the RNA they make are very short and unstable. These are called eRNAs. And then somehow all that fascinating information that's being nucleated at the enhancer has to get to the gene promoter to make the messenger RNA that you're going to then translate into the protein product. And I think the big question in the field is A, what's that information and how does it get from enhancer to promoter? So for enhancers like Schaffner's one that he discovered that are generally close to the gene promoter, I think one can think of simple linear mechanisms to get information from the enhancer sequence to the promoter. You know, if you're a few KBs away from the promoter, I don't think you need to invoke anything very fancy to do that. But as I'm going to show you, in our genome, many, many enhancers are hundreds, if not thousands, of kilobases away from the gene that they're going to activate. And I don't think there's any credible mechanism by which we can think about a linear transfer of information from one place to the other. So we have to invoke some level of 3D genome folding to explain enhancer promoter communication. So that's what I'm going to talk to you about. And I'm going to start by illustrating what we know about very, very long-range gene regulation from the point of view of human genetics. I think we forget that the human is a very powerful model organism, and because we're so acutely aware of our phenotypes, we're able to really explore new mechanisms of disease very thoroughly. So I'm going to illustrate this with actually a gene that Guillaume talked about, SOX9. Here's the SOX9 gene. It's got a lot of enhancers spread upstream of the gene. If you don't have SOX9, it's very important for many decisions during development, so you end up with a disorder called campomelic dysplasia. So very severe problems with development of the limbs, but also problems in breathing and facial development, and also genital development, because you lose all functions of SOX9 in all tissues. However, if you delete one of the enhancers of SOX9, you end up with a very distinct and separate phenotype, different from campomelic dysplasia, because the only function of SOX9 that's disrupted in this disorder called Pierre-Robin sequence is the role of the SOX9 gene in development of the lower face, so that you have a very low, small jaw and problems in the positioning of the tongue. Now this deletion that causes Pierre-Robin sequence takes out a cranial facial enhancer for SOX9 that's 1.45 million bases away from the SOX9 gene. So this is clearly the enhancer for this gene. The genetics tells us that very, very clearly. This is just a remarkable genomic distance to separate an enhancer from a gene. Other structural abnormalities in chromosomes can produce the same effect. So here, a translocation a million base pairs uptime as upstream SOX9 that takes that craniofacial enhancer for SOX9 off and sends it onto a different chromosome, and that breaks the effective communication between the enhancer and the protein. You can see other examples there where deletions and translocations, there's also inversions and duplications, which mess up long-range enhancer promoter communication in human, often over very large distances. But you can also have single nucleotide changes in enhancers that produce very severe human disease that we call enhanceropathies. Because these are the binding sites for the tissue transcription factor binding transcription factors. So if you change a nucleotide, you have the potential to abrogate or change the transcription factors that bind. And here I've just given you some examples of that. So, of course, you can have loss of function. You mutate a base, the key transcription factor can no longer bind. An example there from one of my favorite genes, Sonic Hedgehog. There's a four-brain enhancer for Sonic Hedgehog, 460 kilobases away from the gene. A single nucleotide change in that enhancer stops the key 6-3 transcription factor binding, and you therefore fail to activate Sonic Hedgehog in the correct part of the forebrain, ending up with holoprosencephaly, which is a really severe midline brain defect. But you can also have more complex mechanisms. Here an example from aniridia, which is autoregulatory. A single nucleotide change in an enhancer, an I enhancer, 150 kilobase downstream of PAX6, changes the binding site for the product of the gene it regulates, PAX6. So this is an example of one of Guillaume's maintenance enhancers. In this situation, PAX6 expression initiates in the eye, but cannot be maintained. So you end up with an eye malformation called aniridia. And then you can also have gain-of-function mutations, where single nucleotide changes recruit additional or ectopic transcription factors. And I'll show you an example of this now. I'm going to show you an example from the famous LIM enhancer for Sonic Hedgehog. The enhancer is called ZRS. So this is the regulatory landscape for Sonic Hedgehog. I think we've got about 20 known enhancers so far, which have been defined using either reporters or mouse or human genetics. Scattered over a million base pairs of the human or mouse genome. Some of the enhancers are in the intron of Sonic Hedgehog itself. Some are scattered over a large intergenic desert, a gene desert upstream of Sonic Hedgehog. But some are stuck in the introns of housekeeping genes, several genes away from Sonic Hedgehog. I think if any of us were to sit down and design a human genome from scratch, we probably wouldn't come up with a design that looks like this. But evolution cobbled this together, and it clearly works very well. So this ZRS enhancer over there, a million base pairs away, stuck inside the intron of a housekeeping gene called LMBR1, it's got nothing to do with the limb whatsoever, is nevertheless able to regulate expression of Sonic Hedgehog exquisitely in time and place. So the job of this enhancer here is to drive Sonic Hedgehog expression during limb development in the distal posterior margin of the mesenchyme, just over the underlying the ectoderm, which is a source of FGF signaling in limb development. So this enhancer is integrating all kinds of complex signaling information in the developing limb to give you that normal expression. And that dictates how many digits you will have and what identity they will have, you know, your little finger or your thumb, for example. And yet single nucleotide, so that must be a remarkable element to do that, but yet single nucleotide changes in it in different places within this element produce the same phenotype in humans, mice, cats, and chickens of preaxial polydactyly. And what happens in preaxial polydactyly is the enhancer becomes too good. The domain of expression on the posterior distal side of the limb expands, and you now get this little ectopic patch of expression on the anterior side. So this produces sonic signaling on the wrong side of the limb, strong signaling, you end up with too many digits, and your thumb gets confused and thinks it's a finger. And what happens in all these cases is you introduce an extra binding site for an X family transcription factor. This enhancer is already full of X family transcription factor binding sites, but adding extra ones makes the enhancers a little bit too good. So these enhancers have to be really finely balanced to act correctly. And yet, how do they do that over these ridiculously long genomic distances? How does this communication work so exquisitely in time and place? So I think a key clue to how this might happen is when methods like HiSeq came along that allowed people to interrogate the 3D folding of the genome to produce these well-known triangle maps that you've already seen this morning. And it was realized that for genes with these large complex regulatory domains, these domains align with the TAD maps. So here's Sonic Hedgehog and all its enhancers. There's the gene on the left-hand side here. Here's the LIM enhancer there inside LMBR1. So all the known enhancers for Sonic Hedgehog lie in the same TAD as Sonic Hedgehog. And you see this with very many other genes as well. So this was kind of a smoking gun that said there's something about this level of 3D genome organization that must be related to how complex gene regulation works and perhaps how long-range enhancers can work. So let's think about how we make these structures. I think these diagrams are a bit misleading because this isn't really a structure. It's an ensemble of lots and lots of different structures that overall, if you, merge the data from millions of cells, gives you a triangle. But it's quite clear that these structures are made by an amazing molecular machine that runs up and down our genome all the time, 10 times faster than any polymerase we know about, but it's also a very weak motor. It's very easily paused. And this is cohesin. And it brings about this change in 3D genome folding called a loop extrusion, whose mechanism has been worked out by biophysicists and structural biologists in beautiful detail. So cohesin topologically entraps chromatin in two places, and then through the process of ATP hydrolysis and the bending of this domain, it kind of progressively reels in more and more chromatin, until it reaches barriers, and one of those barriers is a motif for the binding sites for CTCF in a particular orientation where cohesin interacts with CTCF and stops or is paused and impeded. And that continual process, this is going on all the time, but cohesin is always falling off, starting again, but altogether that produces a structure, something like this, which is the TAD. So we wanted to test whether Sonic Hedgehog's TAD is important for the function of Sonic Hedgehog itself and its regulation during development. That would be nice to do in the mouse in vivo, but it's pretty difficult to mess with cohesin in vivo because it's essential for cells to divide, for example. So we decided to give up on working on in development per se and go back to a cell culture system that we could control better, which is mouse embryonic stem cells. Trouble there is Sonic Hedgehog is not expressed. It's repressed by polycomb in mouse ear cells, and none of the enhancers are active. There's no active histomodifications anywhere, no ataxic. So how are we going to study long-range gene activation in a system where the gene is repressed and the enhancers aren't active? Well, the approach we took was to become synthetic biologists and to make our own transcription factors to activate the enhancers of Sonic Hedgehog. So that's what we've done. Our original version of transcription factors was based on the TAL effector proteins. We do use DCas9 now as well. So the TAL effectors have a DNA binding domain where two amino acids in the binding domain dictate whether it's going to recognize an A, G, C, or T. So you can very rapidly assemble a DNA binding protein, which is specific for a 14 in the mammalian genome, and we turn that into a transcription factor by fusing it to multimers of the viral acidic activation domain VP16. These work very well. So in our experiments, we've made transcription factors that will bind to the promoter Sonic Hedgehog, that will bind to an enhancer. This is actually a floor plate enhancer, 100 kilobases upstream of Sonic Hedgehog. The forebrain enhancer, SBE2 of Sonic Hedgehog, which is the one mutated in Hohen prosencephaly, and the LIM enhancer, almost a million base pairs away. So we now have control over enhancer activation and gene activation. Now we need control over the cohesin-mediated loop extrusion machinery. And we don't want to do that by standard genetics of knocking it out, because we perturb the cell cycle, the cells will die. So we need a different approach to that. So for this, we've now adopted this fantastic new tool of cell biology, which is Degron technology, where you can rapidly deplete a protein from cells. So the first experiment I'm going to show you is where we've asked the question, does CTCF have any role in long-range gene enhancer activation in mouse embryonic stem cells? So the approach is to tag CTCF with a Degron, a small peptide, that will take CTCF to the cellular dustbin machinery, the proteasome for destruction. We got these tag cells from Alfred Schnorrer in University of San Francisco. So here's the sonic hedgehog tag, and the triangle's now become a square. We've turned it on its side there. And when you degrade CTCF after a few hours of adding auxin to these cells, almost all the CTCF has gone from the cells, and you can see that the TAD has not completely gone away, but it's become very blurry. So there's much more interactions going across between TADs when you don't have CTCF. So now we can challenge ourselves with or without CTCF with our synthetic transcription factors and ask what happens. And this was published a few years ago now, and the answer was nothing. You can still activate sonic hedgehog perfectly well from the gene promoter without any CTCF. You can activate sonic hedgehog from the long-range enhancers without any CTCF. Okay, but that's not to say that the TADs aren't important. Maybe it's not the boundaries per se, which are the key features here, but actually the actual active process of making the TAD, of scrunching this chromatin domain up into a topological structure. So for there, we want to start messing with the cohesin complex itself. So here, we play the same game. Now we tag cohesin itself, and we got these cells from Rob Close's lab at the University of Oxford. This is the RAD21 subunit of cohesin tagged with an aux integron. Now, when we send cohesin to the dustbin for destruction, there's a dramatic effect on 3D genome folding. There is no TAD anymore. There's no 3D structure. You've got this straight line, which is essentially a random walk chromatin fiber. So no TAD to speak of. And now we'll challenge the cells with our transcription factors and ask what happens. And here is where we get a really interesting result, I think. So we're still able to activate sonic hedgehog synthetically if we put our transcription factors directly on the promoter. So you don't need cohesin per se for transcription. We can still activate sonic hedgehog from the enhancer that's 100 kilobases upstream. So you do not need cohesin for enhancers to function per se. But we can no longer activate from the long distance enhancers, 500, a million base pairs away, suggesting that cohesin is required for long range but not short range gene activation. We're now developing this approach, exploring other aspects of cohesin function, and I'm not going to show you the data for this, but we found very similar results to our experiment where we degraded RAD21, when we degrade this component of cohesin called NITBL. Which was originally thought to be the loader for cohesin, but actually turns out to be part of the machinery of loop extrusion. So we get a failure of long-range enhancer activation when we don't have NITBL, but the short-range enhancers work just fine. And this is really intriguing because NITBL is by far and away the major cause of a human genetic syndrome called Cornelia de Lange syndrome, which is an intellectual disability and developmental disorder. So we believe this condition is probably a specific failure of long-range enhancer activation during development. 80% of diagnosed cases of Cornelia de Lange syndrome have a haploinsufficiency of NITBL, but there are also smaller numbers of individuals who've got milder missense mutations in other components of the cohesin machinery. So again, I think human genetics is going to have an important role to play here in helping us understand this mechanism. So our model for pulling this together is we think of enhancers as a point source of a signal, right? Transcription factor binding, everything else that's recruited. And we think that signal is diffusible over a short range, so that an enhancer is a radio beacon sending out a very short-range signal. And any gene that's close enough to the enhancer in space can hear that signal and become activated. Now, if you're a proximal enhancer, you're close enough because you're close enough in the genome. You can't get very far away if you're only 10, 20, maybe 100 kilobases away. But a gene can be close enough to hear the signal from a distal enhancer if it's in the same TAD, because cohesin is keeping it close in three-dimensional space, even though it's miles away in the linear genome. So when you deplete cohesin, a gene is still close enough to the proximal enhancer to hear the signal because of the linear genome separation being relatively small. But for the distal enhancer, the gene is now too far away to be within its sphere of influence because of this, we think, decompaction of the TAD. And in fact, we can see that happening by DNA fish. So what I've done here is label the sonic hedgehog TAD in three places, the left-hand side, the right-hand side, and the middle. And this is in the cells before we add the auxin to degrade the cohesin. You can see, even though this is a megabase of the mouse genome, everything is really tight and kept tight together in space. And when you degrade cohesin, there's a massive expansion of this whole domain. The distances between all the elements become larger. So now I just want turn to another aspect of what TADs might be doing. And that goes back to what are the edges of the TADs for? What are the boundaries for? So it looks like the TAD is important to allow long-range enhancers to reach their target genes within the same TAD. But perhaps the boundaries are there also to stop enhancers here, for example, acting on nearby genes in the linear genome, but in an adjacent TAD, so to stop ectopic enhanced activation. And in many cases, that seems to be the case. And there's many deletions in human and in the mouse where you get ectopic enhancer action when you mess with TAD boundaries. But is that always true? And we went back to look at some old data of ours, which questions that idea. So this is the pattern of sonic hedgehog in the developing limb bud I've already told you about. This is being driven by the ZRS enhancer here. So that's that distal posterior patch of sonic hedgehog expression. And I can't remember why we did this, but we happened to do some in situs for this gene here, MNX1. MNX1 stands for motor neuron homeobox. This is a gene that's mainly expressed in the developing neural tube to help pattern the motor neurons. If you knock this gene out, you have a major defect in motor neuron development, absolutely no defect in limb development whatsoever. And yet we saw a shadow of what looked like MNX1 expression in exactly the place where you would expect sonic hedgehog to be active, suggesting this is MNX1 expression being activated by the limb enhancer. And so we went and quantified this in tissue sections of the mouse. So in the floor plate, there's the floor plate there, of the mouse, we see, of course, lots of sonic hedgehog expression driven by its proximal enhancers, no sign of any MNX1 expression at all. In the premotor neurons, where MNX1 expression is driven by its own enhancer, which is very, very close, 10 kb away from the promoter. Lots of MNX1 expression, no sign of any sonic hedgehog expression. But in the limb bud, in the zone of polarizing activity where sonic is active, of course, we have sonic hedgehog expression, but we could also clearly see alleles of MNX1 which were active. Moreover, when we made a deletion of 35 kilobases, which takes out this TAD boundary, little effect on expression of sonic hedgehog in the limb, but a massive upregulation of MNX1 in the limb, providing further evidence this is indeed ectopic activation of MNX1 by the limb enhancer across the TAD boundary. And we could reproduce this with our synthetic system. So here we're activating ZRS in mouse embryonic stem cells synthetically. I've shown you before that you can activate sonic hedgehog, of course, with these synthetic factors, but we could also activate MNX1 in these same cells. And this was the expression of sonic hedgehog was not much affected by the deletion of the boundary there, but MNX1 expression went up when we synthetically activated the limb enhancer. So that we thought, well, is this something weird about the ZRS? It's an unusually large and complex enhancer. What about the other enhancers, sonic hedgehog? So we've started walking down this domain, testing in mouse development where whether we can see signs of MNX1 expression in sonic expressing tissues. And indeed we can. So we can see low level but detectable MNX1 transcription in the developing lung buds and the foregut, where in sonic hedgehog expressing tissues where the enhancers are located in this next housekeeping gene down closer to sonic hedgehog, still a long way from sonic itself, RNF32. So we're gradually working our way through this TAD to see when does this ability to reach out a cascade across the TAD boundary decay away. So this gives us an interesting situation where we can again go back and test this idea about this sphere of influence model that enhancers are a source of diffusible signal. Because if that model is correct, then there's no reason why a single enhancer cannot simultaneously induce transcription from two genes at exactly the same time, from exactly the same allele in a single cell. I think no reason why that shouldn't occur. Whereas if you go back to some of the older textbook models of how enhancers work, which is kind of looping model where the enhancer loops around and touches a gene, then you should have mutually exclusive expression. You should either loop to Sonic Hedgehog and express it, or you should loop to MNX1 and express it, and you might flip between the two, but it shouldn't occur at the same time. So we were able to, with our RNA fish, to go back to the tissues and our ES cells to look at whether MNX1 and Sonic Hedgehog expression from the same allele on the same chromosome were mutually exclusive or not. And they were not. We saw, of course, some examples where you only detect MNX1 or Sonic Hedgehog, but we also detected many examples where we could see simultaneous nascent transcription at Sonic Hedgehog and MNX1. So I think that is much more consistent with this model than the looping model. And moreover, Ian Williamson in my lab, who did this work heroically, after he'd done all the RNA fish to score the transcription, he went back to exactly the same nuclei on the tissues and measured the 3D distances between the two genes and the ZRS. And quite remarkably, we found that in the situation where we can see transcription at MNX1, either by itself or with Sonic Hedgehog, that occurred when all the distances were really short, when all the regions were really close together, again, consistent with this model. So MNX1 might be in the adjacent TAD, but it's only 150 kilobases away from the limb enhancer, so it's always going to be pretty close. So I think it's quite conceivable that MNX1 can kind of accidentally finds itself able to be activated by the ZRS at some frequency. It has no effect on biology. It's a bystander. I think as long as it's not detrimental to development, it's tolerated. So what is the mechanism of this communication again? Does it depend, like these mechanisms, on cohesin? So we were able to do the same thing with our auxin degron cells. Degrading CTCF changed nothing. We're still able to see MNX1 activation when you don't have any CTCF there, but it doesn't go up when you take CTCF away and blur that boundary. But when we degrade cohesin, I've shown you before this massive decrease in our ability to activate Sonic Hedgehog, the real gene, but we also decrease the ability to activate MNX1 across the TAD boundary from the limb enhancer, suggesting that indeed it is cohesin running through this region which is responsible for the activation. We think we get misled by thinking the TAD boundaries are actual brick walls, but they're not. If you measure the insulation scores and the number of interactions in high Cmaps that are between TADs, they're only about twofold down compared to the interactions within the TAD. So there's plenty of molecules going through there and bringing these two regions together. So I think our proximity model explains how you can activate two genes at once from the same enhancer. So ZRS can activate Sonic Hedgehog because cohesin's keeping it close in space. It can activate MNX1 because mainly it's not very far away in the genome. When you degrade cohesin, Sonic Hedgehog promoter is too far away to ever hit the signal from the ZRS. But the MNX1 gene, because it's genomically not that far away, it loses some of its ability to be activated, but it still can be activated. So I hope I've shown you that synthetic transcription factors coupled with these exquisite cell biology tools to very acutely remove and then bring back, actually, proteins that are key to 3D genome organization and other cellular functions are a really powerful way now to explore mechanisms of transcription. I hope I've convinced you that cohesin-mediated loop extrusion is key to enabling enhancers to work over large genomic distances. So it's enabled our genomes to grow and for more and more enhancers to be put further and further away from genes and still work. And our overall, I think our data are much more consistent with this kind of hub-pub model of how enhancers work rather than a direct enhancer-promoter looping model. So thank you for listening. I just want to thank the people in my lab who did the work. So the work I've told you about today was done by Ian Williamson, who's a long-standing postdoc in my lab, my research assistant, Sheila, Laura Lettis, who was one of the discoverers of the Sonic Hedgehog Limb Enhancer when she worked for Bob Hill, now retired, Elias Freeman, who's a postdoc in the lab at the moment following up cohesin-mediated loop extrusion, and Luciana, also postdoc in the lab. Many thanks to the generous collaborators who sent us Degron cell lines and to all our fantastic imaging and facts and single cell facilities. And thank you for listening.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.